Good afternoon, you're very welcome to Saturday with Claire Byrne. On today's programme, Labour gets shirty with Fine Gael over water charges, but is it just a political stunt? Or can the junior coalition party reduce the inevitable bill for the less well-off? The Department of Finance wants to see £2 billion shaved off spending in this year's budget, despite an improving economy. We'll hear what the SIP2 president has to say about it. And we want them to like us, says one historian who reckons the government invite to the royal family to attend the 1916 Rising celebration is a mistake. But first, the news now with Michael Murphy.
Good afternoon. Police Service of Northern Ireland detectives who were investigating the shooting dead of a man in West Belfast yesterday say the victim may have been killed as a result of a feud involving dissident Republican groups. Tommy Crossan, a father of six children, died after he was shot at an industrial complex. A 26-year-old man has been arrested. Brendan Wright of our Northern staff reports.
The police say Tommy Crossan, believed to have been a former leader of the Continuity IRA, was shot dead in a portable office at his family business in West Belfast. Gunmen fired a number of shots through the window of the office, hitting Mr. Crossan several times in the upper body, and he died at the scene. The police, who described the killing as brutal and barbaric, said Tommy Crossan was known to them, but said that was no excuse for taking his life. Detective Superintendent Jonathan Roberts, who's leading the murder inquiry, said a feud amongst dissident Republicans was one theory police were examining, but he said they were also following a number of other avenues in trying to establish a motive for the killing. Brendan Wright, RTE News, West Belfast.
South Korean divers have continued to battle dangerous conditions in their attempts to locate the missing passengers from a ferry that capsized and sank on Wednesday. Officials now say the recovery operation could take 2 months. Weather conditions have improved, but strong currents and poor visibility are hampering the search operation. More than 270 people, most of them schoolchildren, are still missing. The father of one of the missing students, Kim Byung-kwan, accused the South Korean government of being disorganised in its response to the tragedy.
The responsibility rests on the government, the Coast Guard, the Navy, all of them. I don't know how to explain all of this. How can a whole country be so disorganised? It's frustrating. All I can say is it's frustrating. I just hope the children, the mothers, the fathers trapped in that ship can be rescued.
Two men have been brought before a special sitting of Cork District Court on several charges relating to the theft of a van and a subsequent high-speed chase, which led to a Gorda being injured. Damien Fitzgerald of Fair Hill in Cork City and John O'Driscoll of No Fixed Abode were remanded in custody by Judge Olan Kelleher. There was no application for bail, and the two men are to appear again at a sitting of the District Court next Thursday. Australian officials coordinating the search for the missing Malaysian airliner say the current underwater phase could be completed within a week. A robotic submarine is mapping a remote stretch of the Indian Ocean floor for signs of flight MH370, which disappeared last month with 239 people on board. Commenting on the incident, Ryanair's chief executive Michael O'Leary said nobody in the airline industry can understand why the plane's transponder was turned off. Speaking on RTE Radio this morning, he said he expects that airlines and international authorities will respond by ensuring that transponders can't be disconnected in future.
It has all the hallmarks of a depressurisation incident because the plane seems to have flown for an undue length of time until it, I presume, ran out of fuel, which is very much what tends to happen in those rare depressurisation incidents. What's unusual is that the transponder has been turned off, and that's not just flicking a switch. I mean, it needs a degree of knowledge to be able to turn it off. But it's hard to believe that somebody's going to take control of a plane and fly it willingly for 4 or 5 hours before it runs out of fuel.
Rescue workers in Nepal have recovered the body of a 13th local guide who was killed in yesterday's avalanche near the Everest base camp. The Sherpas were fixing ropes for mountaineers in a narrow climbing pass when the avalanche hit. Three Sherpas are still missing. The weather forecast. It'll be sunny this afternoon and this evening and dry, apart from isolated light showers in western counties. Highest temperatures of 13 to 16 degrees generally, but a little lower on east-facing coasts. Back now to Clare.
Michael, thank you very much. This is Saturday with Clara Byrne. We'd like to hear from you today on any of the topics we're about to cover in the programme. 51551 is the text number. The email address is saturday@rte.ie. And on Twitter, you can find us at SaturdayRTE. Joining us today in the studio, we have Joe Costello, Minister of State at the Department of Foreign Affairs. Mary Lou MacDonald, Sinn Féin Vice President, is in Derry. Jack O'Connor, the SIPTU President, is with us here in the studio in Dublin. Katie Hannan, Political Correspondent with RTE's Current Affairs Department, is also here, and later Dermot Ferreter will be here to discuss the royal invitation that is on the way, we believe, to the 1916 Rising celebrations and why he might have an issue with it. But first today, we found out this week what we can expect to be paying in water charges from October of this year. Now, the revelation of the figure caused some political problems, which we'll discuss in a moment. But first, let's have a listen to Taoiseach Enda Kenny speaking in the Dáil on Wednesday.
The level of taxpayer subvention for Irish Water, consistent with it being classified as a commercial state company, could not exceed a level of 537 million subvention in 2015 and 2016. And that equates to an annual average metered charge of €240 per annum. I want to say to you that the government have not signed off on these figures.
Now, that was the issue that caused the problem, the revelation of the €240, because we read about it in the Irish Independent before Taoiseach made that statement. And that seemed to be a matter, Joe, that annoyed the Labour Party. Is that fair?
Yes, that's fair to say, because the memo came before the Cabinet and there was no detail in relation to the issues that the Labour Party had raised. Also the issues that are in the programme for government, which makes it quite clear that the objective is to install water meters in every household in Ireland and move to a charging system that is based on use above the free allowance.
And now we know that all of those water meters won't be installed at all before
so
we get to
there's
October.
Also only 25% of the water meters are there, so there's issues that have to deal with that. There's issues in relation to the government subsidy. There's issues in relation to people who are less well off. There's issues in relation to people who have an illness that require extra water. So none of that was part of the memo. So quite clearly, to come up with a figure of €240 per household was totally out of kilter and was inappropriate. And naturally enough, the Labour Party ministers were going to have none of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of the commentary over the course of the week has suggested that this is a bit of a phony war. Labour knew all of this was coming down the tracks. We all did. We all knew that water charges were coming. And really that this is just a ploy coming up to the election to get people on side, that you're standing up for them.
Absolutely. We all knew that water charges were coming. There's no doubt about that. It's in the programme for government. It was also, of course, part of the deal that was done with the IMF and the ECB and the EU, and Fianna Fáil signed up to that, but they've signed up to full recovery of all the costs without any exemptions, without any free allowance. So we know where Fianna Fáil stand on it, but where we stand on it and where we stated categorically in the programme for government is that it's to be a charging system that is based on use above the free allowance. So we have to find out what the free allowance is going to be. It should be as generous as possible. It should take into consideration the different anomalies that are there. And it's only above that amount then that a charge can come in. Mm-hmm. So an actual specific amount is ridiculous at this point in time.
And treating Labour with disrespect?
Well, I wouldn't say it's treating Labour with disrespect. This is a memo that came from Phil Hogan's department, the Department of the Environment. And obviously it didn't go into the detail that was necessary. It didn't come up with the answers to the questions that the Labour Party naturally requires, and which I'm sure all of the Fine Gael backbenchers will want to see teased out as well. So it's a memo that really was short in detail, and we need to tease out all of the issues that are left out, that haven't been teased out and haven't been dealt with in the memo that was presented to the Cabinet.
Okay, Katie, a lot of your colleagues, political correspondents and analysts said that this was a political stunt from Labour, but it seems what Joe is saying is pretty reasonable, that we don't have the detail, and to come up with a figure when you don't have the level of detail is a little premature.
Yeah, there was definitely a sense around Leinster House on Wednesday and Thursday that there was a bit of a very public strop being thrown by Labour, and that this had more to do with the upcoming elections than any big surprise on Labour's front that there was going to be a charge in or around the €240 mark. But I think you have to be fair as well, you have to look at the lack of detail that was in that memo. And certainly it seemed that Fine Gael were anxious. They had made a promise that they were going to put out a figure there before the election. And they believed that they were honouring that promise, putting out this 240. This is what you will hear from any Fine Gael source. Labour, though, are feeling extremely vulnerable in that. If you go back to the last time there was an attempt to impose water charges, Brendan Howlan was the Minister for the Environment at that time. And he will know more than anybody else that one of the key issues that was certainly exploited by anti-water charge campaigners was the fact that it was a flat charge. And that the emergence now of a realisation that 70% at the very most will have water meters at the time that the charge is going to be imposed really cast this in another light. And I do think that Labour have genuine concerns in relation to the political fallout from this.
So it's looking more like a tax, you're saying, rather than a water charge.
That would be Labour's fear in relation to this. And also, of course, the whole issue of the vulnerable groups, the families with large children, people living alone, older people, how these free allowances are going to be worked out. I think there was some dismay that more work hadn't been done in relation to that ahead of this cabinet meeting last week.
Jack, people might be surprised to see that SIPTU are not opposed to water charges.
Well, our preferred course would be that we wouldn't have set up the state company at all, and the provision of water would have stayed with the local authorities, and there would have been some kind of coordination of that. But the policy decision we took at the 2011 conference was that, given that it was a Troika requirement and given that it was going to happen in any event, that we would not oppose it if the free allowance was adequate to meet the needs of the relevant household in each case.
And what do you reckon to where we're at now with this and flat charge and 240, the average?
Well, I don't know to what degree those figures will ultimately emerge, but the leaving aside the politics of it, the principle of it should be this, that given that we've now gone down the road of the state company and the metering and so on, the first thing is to ensure that it's not being set up for privatisation in future when Labour might not be in the government. And the second thing is to ensure that the principle that applies is a charge on waste rather than a charge for what should be a public good. And if it transpires that the free allowance is adequate to meet the needs of the household, and if there is a reasonable waiver system put in place to meet the needs of people who can't pay a charge, or something like that, some accommodation for such people, and if it is quite clearly applied as a conservation measure, then we will not oppose it. Mm-hmm. Although we would prefer if things were done otherwise.
But I think the reality is, and what has to be accepted from, if you listen back again to what Enda Kenny said in that clip you used there, Claire, is that the absolute maximum subvention that can be given to Irish Water, Taoiseach Éireann, is 537 million. If you go beyond that, they are told that it will no longer qualify as a commercial semi-state. So if you take that on board, if you take it's going to cost €1 billion to deliver the water, you are then looking at who has to pay the rest of the 460 whatever. And after that, you're just looking at how you divvy it up. That's the bottom line. Like, it just which vulnerable group gets the most allowance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we're still in the situation, notwithstanding all the difficulties, that we still have a sovereign government. And and we still have to try to apply policies and strategies which address the key issues, and the key issues were clearly signalled, for example, in the report of the Intergovernmental Committee on Climate Change. Mm-hmm. And if the thing is to be reduced to the commodification of a public good, then it will not command public support. And in relation to your question at the outset, Claire, if it transpires that that's what it is, then my union will be opposing it.
Okay, so if we're looking at Irish Water being privatised down the line, that's where you're going.
Yeah, but even no, but apart from that, in the context of what's coming imminently, if what transpires is in effect a charge for what should be a public good, then we will be duty bound to oppose that. If what transpires is a charge or a tax on waste as a conservation measure, then we've declared we won't oppose that.
I wonder who pays for the leaking pipes. You know, if there's a pipe leaking outside your house, is that are you paying for that?
At the present time, of course, there is no charge.
Well, we know that, but from October, you know, who...
Well, there's a free first fix. The first, if there is a leak outside your house, there is a free first fix. So that would be dealt with. After that, it's a different matter. But at the present time, the situation is that there is, all water is free. Approximately 1.2 billion is the cost to the state. The commercial sector pays about 200 to 300 of that. And the rest of it comes from government subsidies in one form or another is paid for it. So Katie said there about 537, I think it's about 567 million. That is the figure that the government subsidy at least will be. Now it's a question of, we have still haven't defined and decided what that government subsidy will be. But remember, the original money that was, or the original decision that was made by the previous government was that there would be no government subsidy at all, that it would be full cost recovery. So that would be, that was estimated at the time,
it would
be
about 400.
Oh, this is going to be enormous improvement, and it's a budgetary matter to decide what that subsidy will be, and it's also a budgetary matter to decide what the free allowance will be. They'll all have to be built into the budget.
I know, but somebody has to make up the numbers, is Katie's very valid point. That, you know, you can only put in a certain amount of money in a state subsidy in order to for this company to qualify under the rules. But and the rest of it, the cost up to 1.2 billion, will have to be paid by everybody
else. Let us get
else.
Back to the purpose of the legislation, which is stated in the programme for government. And that is that it's only the people that will be charged are the people who will use above the free allowance. So the important thing is to deal with the free allowance and ensure that that's operating effectively and efficiently.
Okay, I want
and then the charge kicks in after that. And if we have a fair and equitable system in relation to the free allowance, in relation to the subsidy, I think then that people will recognise this is an environmental issue, this is a conservation issue, and that people won't see it in other
and
terms.
And
than
not
that.
Just a revenue raising tax.
It's Mary, not a revenue raising
Mary
tax.
Lou McDonald, Sinn Féin Vice President and TD in our in Derrybeg today. You must welcome Labour's moves on this. They're trying to make it more fair, more equitable.
Well, I notice the panic that's very evident now within the Labour Party in particular, but I imagine more generally within government circles. I think that was very evident in the course of the week as this memo was leaked in the first instance to the media and then came to Cabinet and was fairly threadbare in terms of detail. I think any sensible person realises that if a government is serious about taking measures that are about conserving water and protecting the environment, then they should be investing money in fixing the infrastructure. I mean, up to 40% of treated water is wasted. That is absolutely scandalous. And I think any sensible, rational person would argue that the monies that have been spent, rather than setting up a new structure, rather than shelling out over 80 million in consultancy fees, rather than using almost half a billion from the National Pension Reserve Fund to install meters, it would have been a far more sensible, a far more equitable and a far more environmentally friendly approach to actually fix the infrastructure. So I don't think, Claire, that you're going to convince anyone, or the Labour Party or Fine Gael are going to convince anyone, that this tax is about protecting the environment or saving water. If they were that concerned about that issue, they would invest in the infrastructure itself. On the issue of catering for low-income groups, for people who are struggling, I think it's very little, very, very late from the Labour Party and others. The facts are that even aside from people who are reliant on social welfare, for instance, people are out of work or pensioners, you have a whole section of society now who are at work, who would be traditionally considered to be within the middle classes. And they are struggling and struggling very badly. They can barely make their ESB bills, meet their mortgage payments or their rent or their childcare bills as things stand. They could not sustain another bill. I note that Joe and his colleagues now belatedly have recognised the realities of people's domestic finances. I wonder why it has taken them so long to wake up to this reality. And I would just suggest to them that in forcing people to pay for water, which after all is not a luxury, it is one of the most basic necessities for human life and for any decent standard of living, forcing people to pay for that will by definition bring a level of hardship to families, irrespective, Claire, of whatever minor tweaking the Labour Party might achieve at this very late
stage. But you can't
stage.
Blame Labour for forcing people to pay for water, because this was a Troika instruction, and it also had to be included in this year's plan sent through to the European Commission. So
I mean, the Troika have gone, and the government were making much of ado about that. There was much fanfare when we waved goodbye to the
Troika. I know,
but
we'd be accusing the government of being dreadfully immature if the Troika left, and the minute they left went, right now, lads, let's change all the plans. Let's not do everything we said we were going to
and
do.
And even, Claire, when the Troika were here, because bear in mind that opposition parties, Sinn Féin, we met with the Troika every time that they paid their review visit to the state. And they were very clear in saying to us consistently that the targets were set in terms of trimming our sales,
numbers.
The overall figures. Mm-hmm. How we actually achieved those was a matter for ourselves. I do recognise the reality of European law, of the Water Framework Directive, and the absolute necessity for this state to ensure that we have a decent and safe water supply.
Okay.
That,
and
is,
also
that is an overwhelming necessity. But
yeah.
I'd suggest again, the way you achieve that is not by presenting people with yet another bill while still allowing 40% mm-hmm. of treated water to seep out of leaky pipes.
Okay.
The sensible thing is
to
invest in
the
infrastructure.
Okay, Mary Lou, I want to come back to Joe Costello and some of those points that you made very little too late from the Labour Party.
This is a usual thing from Mary Lou and Sinn Féin. They're talking out of both sides of their mouth. They're saying one thing in the Republic and they're doing something else in Northern Ireland.
No, we're not.
In the area where they have actual responsibility. Let's not forget they're in a coalition government in Northern Ireland. What have they done there? They have already begun the process of water metering. Conor Murphy, who was the minister, has introduced 25,000 metres in Northern Ireland already. They've deferred full action for the time being. But they have a water entity called Northern Ireland Water in place, and it's been operated by a Sinn Féin minister. So they come down then to the Republic and they don't want to pay for anything.
Claire,
anything
can
that
I
happens
answer
in
that?
The Republic,
Joe, Mary's responding to you and you can't hear that if you put your headphones on.
I can't
on.
Hear, but she got a long enough period to make her
well,
point.
Well, you've made a specific charge,
so I think
charge,
Mary,
so I think
Mary
I
Lou,
should be able
Mary
to
Lou,
respond.
You can answer
just let
the
him finish,
specific
Mary Lou.
Charges if I get a chance, half a chance to say half the amount that you just said. Sinn Féin are doing one thing in Northern Ireland where they are in government. Let's not forget that. Then down in the Republic, they're opposing any charge for anything, whether it's a property charge, which is four times the amount our own property charges down here. They oppose that tooth and nail where they stood over it in Northern Ireland. So how can we believe anybody who is putting forward those type of arguments?
Okay.
That they're totally untrustworthy.
Mary Lou.
Well, first of all, Joe, there are no domestic water charges in the north. Let me tell you. Let me tell you why there are no water charges.
There are no domestic water charges in the Republic at the moment.
Joe,
Conor Murphy set up Northern Ireland Water, and he has been introducing 25,000 metres.
Joe, you've made the charge, and let me answer it. And let me just inform you as to the facts. There are no domestic water charges, and do you know why, Joe? The British government were very enthusiastic for domestic water charges, and the administration, and you're quite right to cite Conor Murphy when he was the then minister, led opposition to that. And Sinn Féin...
He led opposition, he introduced
Sinn
it.
Sinn Féin made sure that there were no and there are no domestic water charges. That is the position. That is our stance. And despite the more limited circumstances
that
we find ourselves in,
please.
I'm afraid it
Mary
is
Lou,
factual.
Are you saying there's no property charges in Northern Ireland?
No.
Are you saying there's no water charges in Northern Ireland? Are you saying that Conor Murphy did not set up an entity called Northern Ireland Water to introduce water
Claire,
charges?
Can you ask Joe
what
to let me answer
moment,
this?
Claire,
all right.
What has happened
do you know
at the
what?
Moment?
I want to move on.
No, Claire, I don't want
is
to move on. I want to have the opportunity to answer this.
Because the CD embarrassment, they have now deferred it for the time being, but the charges are being paid through the property tax, which is four
times. Joe, we'll let Mary Lou respond and then we're going to move on. Mary Lou, very briefly and then Jack
O'Connor. Very briefly, and if Joe could stop talking and perhaps listen for 2 minutes, but that's a great relief, I'm sure, to everyone.
Now, Mary Lou, you've got a long run at it, Mary Lou.
Joe, there are no water charges in the north. We made sure of that. There is no equivalent property tax in the north. There is a system of rates. And listen, Joe, listen to this very carefully.
Give us a break,
listen
Mary
to this.
Lou.
No, you give me a break and
property,
listen to this very carefully.
Your property tax is four times what it is down
here.
Okay,
we're going to move on.
No.
Jack O'Connor. No, Mary Lou, you got your chance. Jack O'Connor wants to come in.
I'm not in the studio and Joe is obviously trying to take advantage of that fact.
No, I'm not. If you're off on holidays in your holiday home in Donegal, that's your business on the average wage. The average industrial
wage.
Joe,
are you actually that pathetic and that frightened by the upcoming election that you would be
Mary
insulting
Lou, if you're
to
not
me
in the
that
studio,
way?
I'm
Claire,
in the studio
listen,
here.
There's more of us here in the studio that have taken made an effort to come in here today to say one or two things.
Jack, go ahead.
I do regret that people I respect greatly, both of them, in the Labour Party and in Sinn Féin, conduct the debate in this way. The fact of the matter is that actually both of them are correct in a way. You see, when you leave aside the politics, the fact that the Labour Party has taken a stand on this issue now creates space for something good to happen for working people. The fact that the Sinn Féin party is in the government in the north creates space for something good to happen for working people. And I actually do look forward to the day when the people in these two parties offer an alternative government in this jurisdiction here and afford working people and the people who depend on public services a chance to have a say in what happens in Ireland. We've never had that chance since the foundation of the state. And I do think it's a slight digression, but I do think that the people on the parties of the left have to find a narrative to conduct the debate in a different way than it's being conducted between them at the moment. Because the only beneficiaries of this kind of engagement are the people whose interests are served by the parties of the centre-right.
So you want
and
peace to break out between Sinn Féin and Labour?
It feeds the lie that they're all the same. Mm-hmm. Because the people in the Labour Party and Sinn Féin and other people on the left do have an alternative and could, if they were given a chance, offer a better way forward for working people and for the people who depend on public services in this country. But insofar as the immediate issue to hand is concerned, the fact of the matter is that, leaving all politics aside, that the Labour Party is making a stand on this issue to the extent that it can, as the minority party in the government, create space that from which some good will come for working people.
Okay.
And Claire, can I just by way of conclusion at the position, I think there's great merit in that. There are no water charges in the north. There will not be on Sinn Féin's watch. There is no equivalent property tax. There is a system of rates that covers waste disposal, septic tanks, school buses, library services. It is levied and it is a completely different type of charge.
I'm not going to go over this again. We're not in Northern Ireland. We're in the Republic of Ireland.
I'm not even going to reply to Mary Lou. All I'm going to say is that Jack raised the point about privatisation. And the Labour Party is absolutely opposed to privatisation of Irish Water. And I think Mary Lou and the other political parties should make their position clear on that, because, of course, there may well be another government after the next election. There'll be different parties perhaps in government. But at this point in time, that is the question that should be asked of all the political parties.
Liam in Leash has been on to us to say he's been paying for water charges for over 30 years on a water scheme. Another listener says, how do the government plan to police whether there are big teenage families? There should be one standard rate for all families, otherwise people won't try to minimise their usage. And somebody else says they have a house in Enniskill, and Jaden from Oxford, and next week I have to pay £1,000 sterling for an annual rate bill, but Mary Lou outlined what you get for that. Now, I want to move on to the issue of the wider economy, because growth forecasts have been revised upwards. Predicted rate of job creation has also been boosted, and the ESRI have said in recent weeks that we may not need any new austerity measures in this year's budget apart from the money raised from water charges. But despite all of that, the Department of Finance said this week that it wants to see a €2 billion adjustment in this year's budget to bring the deficit to 3% of GDP. Jack O'Connor, what do you make of everything that's going on? We're having conflicting messages. I'm not sure how it affects consumer confidence on the one side. But the Department of Finance saying this, it's a timely reminder that we are still in trouble, really.
Well, of course, the Department of Finance, in the first instance, is being cautious about the figures that are unfolding, and they are quite correct to do so. If the ESRI's projections materialise, then there won't actually be a need for a cut of the order of €2 billion or an adjustment of the order of €2 billion or anything remotely approaching it to achieve the 3% deficit. It's early days yet, but and there is the possibility opening up now to pursue a different approach to economics in 2015 and into 2016. If the kind of projections that are out there now materialise, I'm a bit sceptical of them myself, I have to say, because we had them a year ago and we had efforts to talk up the economy and all of that, and they didn't materialise, and the consumer spend, as of the latest figures we have available to us, is still down. But the thing about it is that we should be looking towards the day when we don't have to do any more cutting or inflicting any more pain on the most vulnerable people in our society. And what I would have preferred to hear from the Department of Finance is not so much we will do this or we will do that, because it's too early to say in terms of the specifics, but I would have preferred them to say that if we can, and if these figures materialise, we will not be inflicting any more pain on the people who depend most on public services.
Mm. But you say they're being overcautious, but in that report they issued during the week, they had a section at the back which went through all of the potential global issues that could affect the economy. And one, for example, was an interest rate rise. And if the interest rates go up over the next short to medium term, the impact on the Irish economy is catastrophic. GDP growth will be cut by 1.4% next year and 2.1% in 2016. Yeah, well, how vulnerable we are.
Yeah, I don't disagree, actually, except that I would be pursuing a different approach. I didn't actually say that they were being overcautious. I said they were being cautious. And my difference with them would be around the aspiration that they're signalling, because it's too early yet to say what can or cannot be done. But there is the possibility opening up to pursue a different approach to economic development for 2015 and 2016. And if we were to bring into play the Strategic Investment Fund in a way that would play into the economy positively.
Because you've been talking about this for a long time.
I've been talking
now
about this since May Day of 2011. Actually, mm-hmm. and calling for the establishment of the Strategic Investment Bank. And John McManus, who is a man I wouldn't normally agree with on very much, nor he with me, I imagine, had a very good article, short article, in last Monday's Irish Times, in which he highlighted the failure of the approach that's being taken in relation to the Ireland Strategic Fund at the present time, because the criterion that's been applied is a completely commercial criteria. And it's a short-term commercial criteria. There is about €6.8 billion there, which could be used to leverage more money for strategically important commercially based propositions.
And get people back to work.
And the other thing that we should be doing, quite frankly, is we should be facing up to the necessity against 5 years plus of wage stagnation or worse, of increasing wages across the economy, so as to do two things: to increase the amount of money that people have at their disposal to spend, and to increase confidence and to signal to people that it's okay to spend now. Because one of the things that the ESRI highlighted in this report, which didn't actually get very much coverage, is that we are still deleveraging in this economy. Both private consumers and business is still deleveraging at a hell of a pace, which is wholly unnecessary and actually counterproductive.
Okay, Katie Hannon, the mixed messages on the economy. I mean, is this again more politics at play before we come to the budget, so that we will be delighted when we get the good news?
Look, we're coming up to European and local elections. The one thing you can be absolutely sure of is there's going to be an awful lot of politics at play. And for every doomsday message that seeps out, there will be another happy clappy message that will come out. And that's exactly if you follow the economic signals that have been coming out of government. I mean, even on the day that that Michael Noonan was talking about the need, you know, the cautioning the need for the perhaps another 2 billion adjustment in the economy, there was, with that talk of promise that we would do something, which is the term we know, you'd do something for the squeeze middle in terms of tax cuts. Mm-hmm. Now, clearly, if you're dealing with a 2 billion adjustment coming down the tracks and you're talking about doing something for the squeeze middle on taxes, that simply means there's going to have to be greater cuts in expenditure. So, you know, that's another choice that's going to be made. And certainly looking at the figures that were, even if you take the ESRIs, and the ESRI seems to be coming, have a different way of doing their sum than the Department of Finance in terms of how we meet the 3% deficit. But if you look at that and the type of sums around that, and the fact that for every 1% increase in GDP, that you'd need 1% increase in GDP to account for about 750, 850 million in that adjustment. You would have to have growth figures like up 4.5%, heading towards the 5% to justify, negate the need for the adjustment. So I think really the idea that that's just going to fall into our laps might be more than a little optimistic at this stage.
All we can do then, Joe, is tinker with the figures. You know, give people a tax break here, but pull it back somewhere else.
No, I don't think so, Claire. The situation that has been taking place has been quite substantial in terms of the economy. We have exceeded growth in the economy for the last 3 years by almost double our GDP figures, where it was supposed to be about 0.7% year before last. It was 1.4%. We have international trade at a level of increase of 6% on an annual basis, where there has been no growth in the economy, in the domestic economy. So now there is beginning to be growth in the domestic economy. And of course, the growth in the domestic economy is crucial. And even without that growth, we created 61,000 jobs last year.
So what do you want to see happen then in this budget? What are you going to give back to people if you had your way?
The first thing we have to do is we're going to continue along the lines that we agreed that we're going to bring down the deficit ratio to 3%. And we're going to meet those targets. There has been different predictions coming from the ESRI than has come from the Department of Finance. But every single year we have beat the target. We have been ahead of the target. And I'm certain that this will be the case this year as well. So that
if nothing happens, if there's no international shock or even a tremor
We are at the present time, we are creating more than 7,000 jobs per month. We're moving ahead faster every time there is a job created. That's 20,000 extra tax into the exchequer. So if we are able to continue creating the jobs, getting people back to work, keeping people from emigrating, then we are going to be able to meet the targets in a manner
taxes.
That will be more flexible. I think the first requirement is to ensure that the ship is steady, that we have a stable economy, that we are meeting.
I know that, but people really want to know, are they going to have a bit
look,
more money
in
their
pockets?
We
would love to be able to cut taxes. We would love to be able to increase wages. Jack is going to be looking very strongly for an increase in wages. And perhaps that's the way forward, because what the more money that comes into people's pockets, the more they spend, the more the domestic economy begins to grow. So these are options that they're going to have to discuss in the run-up to the budget when the figures are available in September and early October.
Mm-hmm. Mary Lou, do you think they'll pull it out of the bag, a tax cut for the middle classes?
I don't know, Claire, to be honest with you. We're now in April and the budget, as everyone knows, isn't read until October. So I think the spade work or the preparatory work will be done over the summer months, August into September. I think our position has been, and we've argued in budget submission after budget submission year after year, that the real necessity to get to steady the ship and to put us on the right track is to get movement and dynamism in the domestic economy. And that means investing to get people back to work. Everybody knows I'm here in rural Donegal, speaking to you from a studio here, and certainly you go through the parishes around here. And they will tell you of the devastation of emigration again from rural communities. It's hit cities too. So we've lost another generation to emigration. There has been some movement, some positive news in terms of job creation, but we still lack any of the vision or plan or scale of investment that's required here in the domestic economy to really bring that positive shock to the system to engender confidence and to put us on a positive trajectory.
So you'd be on the same page as Jack O'Connor, really, in terms of the Strategic Investment Fund.
Absolutely. And I think SIPTU, in fairness, has argued a very similar line to ourselves now for the last number of years. Of course, Jack has the ear of his Labour Party colleagues, and it's just a pity that he hasn't been more successful in convincing them as to his line of thinking and the union's line of thinking. So I would have thought, and bearing in mind that we have recent news again around the health budget running again now, very much outside the kind of boundaries that the government had envisaged. 530
million, yes. I think, according to The Independent today.
That's what it could look like at end of year. We have a situation where there have been the most severe levels of cutbacks to public services. People know all about that. So there really isn't the capacity, and there cannot be the stomach for more cutbacks to more public services or another attack on people on low and middle incomes. So I would think, and we would think, that the balance of the emphasis needs to be absolutely on investment, stimulus, job creation, get people off the dole queues, get the money into the exchequer and get us onto that positive traction. Because whatever about the international trading figures and the export figures, they're important. But much, much more important is the domestic economy, and that continues to stagnate. Okay.
Yeah, with regard to Mary Lou's remarks about my Labour Party colleagues and my ability to convince them or otherwise, with respect to you, Mary Lou, that's not the problem. The Labour Party, as I recall, in its electoral programme, proposed the Strategic Investment Bank. The problem is not convincing them. The problem is convincing the electorate, because the fact of the matter is that more than 60% of the people who went out to vote in the last election, as you well know, voted for the parties that guaranteed the better off, that they'd have to contribute nothing, and voted for the parties that didn't promote the idea of a strategic investment bank. So the problem is not convincing the minority party in the government. The problem is convincing the electorate, and the problem that the people on the centre-left, such as yourself and Joe Costello and all of us face, is presenting a cohesive alternative to the people that they can buy into and believe in, and we won't do it as long as we're sniping at each other in the way that we're conducting our politics at the present time. Now the thing about it is that there is a rational argument, a very rational argument, that wouldn't necessarily offend the dominant party in the government for the utilisation of the Strategic Investment Fund in a constructive, progressive manner, rather than simply restricting it to the rules of high finance as we know it to date. And if we could do that, we could play €6.8 billion into the economy over the next 3 years, and whatever else it could leverage, which could be two or three times that.
OK, Jack, we're going to have to leave that one there, because we have Dermot Farrator waiting to join us, and we'll be talking in a moment about whether the Royals should be invited to our 1916 commemoration. You are listening to Saturday with Clare Byrne. We have Minister of State of the Department of Foreign Affairs, Joe Costello, the Sinn Féin Vice President and TD, Mary Lou MacDonald, who's in Derrybeg, Jack O'Connor, the SIPTU President, Katie Hannan, Political Correspondent with RTE's Current Affairs Department, and we've just been joined by Professor of Modern History at UCD, Dermot Farrator. And it's to Dermot's area of concern we move to now, because in the course of the visit to Britain by President Michael D. Higgins, it became apparent that an official invitation will be extended to members of the royal family to attend the 1916 commemoration celebrations here. Now, first of all, our reporter Michael Lawless asked these people in Dublin what they think of that decision.
The level of taxpayer subvention for Irish Water consistent.
That was Enda Kenny. We'll come to that clip in just a moment. We may come to it now. No, OK, we'll leave it and move on. There seems to be a problem with it. But the decision was broadly welcomed, as you probably know. There are some dissenting voices. Dermot Farrator, you're among those dissenting voices, that has to be said. You're on this expert advisory group, just to explain to people. It was set up to advise on the commemorations. Is the first issue here that the group wasn't consulted about this decision.
That certainly is one of the issues, because it makes you wonder what is the point of the existence of that group if they're not going to be consulted in relation to a decision of this magnitude. And I say that deliberately because it was an announcement that created quite a lot of surprise. Just to explain what that group is about, it was established by the Taoiseach in 2011. There's 10 or 11 historians on it, and the idea was that they would work with the government to assist them in the commemorative projects. And just to, you know, we had to actually articulate what our particular aim and brief was as a group of historians who've, as you can appreciate, a range of views about a variety of different things. We were asked to ensure that significant events are commemorated accurately, proportionately and appropriately in tone. And we also, as part of our brief statement, said that there should be no attempt to contrive an ahistorical or retrospective consensus about the contemporary impact and legacy of divisive events. And finally, that the state cannot be expected to be neutral about the events that led to its formation. So there are some of the issues we're looking at. And I mean, I'm not here to denigrate all of the government's commemorative efforts, because they've actually made some significant announcements about the opening of archival material and the funding of the military archives and the Century Ireland project, which is making really valuable source material accessible to people. So it's not about that. What I'm concerned about is this particular announcement that was made. Obviously, people are aware of it now because of what the Queen said during the state banquet in Windsor. But it was actually Eamon Gilmore who unveiled this first last September, in Cambridge at the British-Irish Association. And I'm a bit concerned about the elitism of all of this. This was originally unveiled by Gilmore at that particular event. It's hardly a People's Assembly now, the British-Irish Association, quite a rarefied atmosphere. I don't know if he was flying a kite. But what we obviously know, these decisions are not made quickly. Diplomats have obviously been working on this behind the scenes on both sides. And then it was the formal declaration in the Queen's speech that members of my family and government will stand side by side. And the Taoiseach then reacted to that by saying that he would consult with authentic historians, which some people found bizarre. But I presume that's what he was referring to, the expert advisory group. Now, obviously, from the language that the Queen used, it's quite clear that she herself is not going to be standing outside the GPO reading the proclamation in 2016. It's obviously going to be a representative of the family that is not a senior in rank. But you do have to question the appropriateness of it at all. When you consider what is being marked in 2016, surely the very antithesis of a monarchy is the declaration of a republic, as happened in 1916. And I would just be concerned that what we have here is obviously a dividend from the peace process in relation to the warmth of Anglo-Irish relations. There's quite a momentum underpinning that warmth now, and it's a very positive one. But that, to me, is separate from the issue of commemorating 1916. And it does seem to me that there's a clash here of contemporary politics and history and commemoration. And it's not the business of an expert advisory group to be furthering the business of the peace process.
So this skews the history of this event,
I think,
potentially.
It does. But it also means the focus is going to be on the royal presence. That will be the story of 2016. That is not appropriate and it's not wise. And some people find it bizarre, frankly, that you would have that focus. Inevitably, there would be a security lockdown if there are royals in Dublin in 2016. And it seems to me it would take the focus away from what we need to be focusing on, which was trying to understand the motivations behind 1916 and all that followed.
OK, we have that. We have Michael Lawless's report. I said earlier on that he asked people in Dublin what they thought of the decision, the likely decision to invite members of the royal family to those celebrations. Let's have a listen to what Michael found out.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing because it shows that we're not all caught up in the past and that we can move on with things.
Things have got closer, things have got better, move ahead. Let bygones be bygones.
No, she shouldn't be, because she's not welcome in Ireland, because no one wants her here.
Yeah, I think so. I think history should be left as history, new beginnings.
Yes, I think they should. Why? Because I think Ireland has moved on and it's not at war with Britain now to show that we have actually grown up as a nation and we're not a small teenager that's still looking for a fight with the world.
Of course, why not? Anything that can improve relationships between two countries after a troubled past would be a bonus.
Yes, I think so, definitely.
Well, I'd have no problem with it once they stayed in the background. Once they didn't focus much on them, you know, I wouldn't object to them being at it once we focused on the men of 1916.
Absolutely, all and every one of them, in their kills and without their kills.
I don't know, if they're involved with it, yeah, if they're not, it's all the same to me whether they come or not, you know what I mean? They don't care. Look at their government, they'll invite anybody.
They'll invite anybody, says that woman. Mary Lou MacDonald, what's your view on this?
Well, I think one of the difficulties is that the announcement, even though, as Diarmaid has pointed out, that it had been announced, it was the re-announcement of an announcement, if you like, sort of caught people by surprise. I'm curious to know the logic behind it. I think all of us recognise and welcome the fact that the progress has been made, that the relationship between Ireland and Britain is now much stronger, that we have made such significant progress in the peace process, and anything that can assist that, of course, is to be welcomed. But, you know, when we commemorate the centenary of 1916, it's a moment, it's a pause for reflection for us here, to ask ourselves, I think, fairly fundamental questions like, do we actually live in a republic? That republic that was proclaimed on Easter week on the steps of the GPO, that promised rights to citizens, that promised the ownership of Ireland to the people of Ireland, that talked about cherishing all of the children of the nation equally. Are we there or are we not? And it is also, of course, a moment to reflect on the enormous heroism, not just of the men of 1916, but indeed of the women too, and of that revolutionary generation. And of course, it brings to mind the fact, in a democratic sense, that Ireland remains partitioned, that we now have a peaceful and a democratic dialogue and participation and pathway to reunification. So one of the women that you asked on the streets of Dublin said, well, if they were here, that might be OK, but you wouldn't want the focus to be on the royals, you know, at a commemoration of this nature. And I think therein lies the danger.
So do you agree with it or not?
I would remain to be convinced of it,
because Diarmaid says it smacks of post-colonial inferiority complex,
yes,
that we just want them to like us.
I think there is a danger in that. I note that Diarmaid, and I've heard him speak on this issue before, use the word bizarre. I've heard other people describe it as perhaps a little bit perverse. I don't have a closed mind to any of these matters, but the only thing that we wish to see is appropriate commemoration, and that it doesn't become sort of a jamboree for people at the top. It has to be a genuine celebration and moment, pause for reflection. Bear in mind also, Claire, if you go down onto Moore Street in Dublin and you go to the terrace there and the laneways of history, as the Taoiseach described them, the site of the action, most of the action, and indeed the ultimate surrender of the leadership of 1916, it is in a derelict state. So, I mean, I wonder, you know, to what extent the government has its thinking straight on this. I mean, I'll be speaking in Derry this Easter. We have 143 commemorations, Sinn Féin, right across Ireland. We work every Easter. It's probably our busiest time. And people gather every year to really reflect, to mark the heroism of those times,
okay,
but also to ask the questions of, do we live in a republic?
All right.
And I don't believe we do. So the next question is, how do we achieve the republic?
Okay, I just want to move to other members of the panel now. Billy Kelleher from Fianna Fáil, Joe Costello, said the invite is superficial. He said he cringed when he heard it and it was done without thought. He reckons political parties should have been consulted. This should have been talked about in the Dáil before this invitation was mooted at all.
Well, as you said earlier, this has been raised by Eamon Gilmore at the British Irish Association, which is not that, as the German says, that very elitist body. It has been raised in the context of the recent visit. And of course, Martin McGuinness was present from representing Sinn Féin with the Queen in Windsor. So that's the other perspective there. But we're talking about this in the overall context of a decade of celebrations, a decade of centenary commemoration. And it's a question now to look at what might be appropriate. Don't forget that we are already been going up to Belfast, going over to London in relation to some of the activities that have taken place in relation to events that have were part of that decade. And relation, for example, the Battle of the Somme. I was up in Belfast myself laying a reed there. So
but
there is a participation.
Diarmaid Ferreter, part of this expert advisory group appointed by your government, not consulted on this, not told about
it. Well, I think this is the opportunity now for that special advisory group. Don't forget that there's also a special parliamentary group that I was a member of, and we dealt with the archives in that at that time. Now, there's no reason why both bodies could not be brought into play to see what is an appropriate way of engagement.
But that's about asking for the advice after the decision has been made. And this is a key issue about consultation, Joe.
Just let him respond, because we've limited time.
In relation to consultation, this is an issue here. This is not a legacy that belongs to diplomats or the government. It belongs to the people. And you would like to think that there would be some form of discussion about this, which is why I'm intervening about this. If you consider who it is appropriate to talk to about this, it is something that should be debated. What about the descendants, for example, of those who participated in 1916? Should they not be talked to as well? There's a sense that this decision has been made and now we're going to throw you a bone. But if you consider that we've long moved beyond the single heroic nationalist narrative of Irish history, Joe's mentioned there, the state is fully committed to honouring the Battle of the Somme, the dead of the Battle of the Somme and the Irish people who served in the British Army. We're long past a stage where we only had one side of the story. But are we going to get to the stage now in 2016 where the pendulum is going to have swung so far that there isn't going to be any kind of space to actually look at the significance of republicanism 100 years ago? But also, of course, not just, it's not about, Mary mentioned there, the heroism of 1916. It's also about the victims of 1916. It's about women's history. It's about labour history. There's much more of a focus now on the children who were killed in 1916. There is an opportunity there to commemorate in a very measured and dignified way. But this royal focus or this royal story in 2016 would surely take away from that.
Jack O'Connor.
Yeah, I don't want to get involved in the debate about the process, who did what and so on, or who's doing what or so on. But I want to come to this from a completely different place. And I want to say that if we are actually really serious about commemorating the heroic women and men of 1916, that we should be doing something quite differently. And I was very impressed yesterday morning to hear Cian McCormack interviewing two ladies who were the mothers of they were of young families.
Oh, this on Morning Ireland.
Yes, who had been written to by their banks, and they were told effectively to vacate their homes because they were unable to service the mortgages anymore. Now, we have at this moment in time of the order of 90,000 people languishing on housing waiting lists. And we know that tens of thousands, we don't know quite how many, but tens of thousands of people over the next 2-3 years are going to be getting letters to vacate their homes. If we were really serious in this country, all of us, and this is not about blaming the government or anyone else, if we were really serious, we'd take one major social project, like homelessness, and we would tackle that, and we would declare collectively that over the 5 years between now and the centenary of the democratic programme, we will deal with that problem.
Okay.
And that was that would resonate, Claire, far better with the people in East Belfast that we're trying to reach out to than all this militaristic jingoism that I fear is going to unfold.
Okay, Katie,
over the next period.
Briefest word here on whether this could materialise into a big, huge row.
There's a row already. I mean, I think I'm the same vintage, I think, as Dermot here. And I think we would have gone to school with a copy of the proclamation over the blackboard at school. And it was taught to us in a very black and white way. And, you know, as you said, we've come a long way from that. But sorry, it was always going to be tricky enough to call this right on the day, to hit all the right notes. I think with Camilla and Charles in the middle of it, it might be extremely challenging. Indeed.
Respect can be afforded from a distance.
Can I just say, Claire, my father fought in the War of Independence. My uncle did. My uncle wouldn't go to the United Kingdom. He went to Scotland to earn his fare to go to the United States. So I'd be very conflicted with this, that it has to be done in a manner which respects the integrity of what people did at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it shouldn't be not recognised that we are now in a different phase of engaging in a peace process with the United Kingdom.
We've got to leave it there. We are over time. Thank you all very much indeed for joining us back with Saturday with Claire Byrne next Saturday at 1 o'clock. Enjoy your Easter weekend.
Saturday with Claire Byrne was produced by Roisin Boyd. The researcher is Leslie Anderson. The broadcast coordinator is Maeve Mooney. And audio supervision this week was by Noel Roberts.